Hi there, I'm Cosmo. I'm the co-founder of Beckley SciTech, also long-standing contributor to Beckley Foundation, the charity. Been involved in psychedelic research my whole life, even before I was an adult. And I'm delighted to be here with you on Professionally Psychedelics.
Hey there, listener, and welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast. Today, I am really pleased to be joined by Cosmo Fielding Mellon, CEO of Beckley SciTech. Born out of the Beckley Foundation, a world-renowned organization who have been central to drug policy reform and research into psychoactive substances for over two decades, Cosmo and his team are at the forefront of modern-day psychedelic science. With clinical trials currently at play and a bulging financial war chest following an oversubscribed Series B funding round, I cannot wait to hear what's being cooked up at Beckley HQ. So, with all this in mind, there's only one thing left to say. Cosmo, welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
Thank you very much. Really looking forward to chatting. So, thanks.
An absolute pleasure. I cannot wait to pick your brain here. So, without further ado, Cosmo, what led you to plant medicines?
Right. Well, it's a good question. I suppose, you know, I probably didn't have very much say in it, if I'm completely honest, because I was born into it, I would say. So as you mentioned, my mother and indeed my father, actually, so both of my parents have really devoted their entire kind of adult lives to the psychedelic cause in their belief that psychedelics have enormous potential to help humanity in the world, basically. So they from as long ago as the 60s, they've really been single-mindedly obsessed with this as their cause and their way to make a difference in the world. And so when I was born, you know, I was arguably brainwashed from birth that this was the most important important cause, the most interesting subject, and all of that. So it was, you know, so my mother is very well known. She's called Amanda Fielding, and she set up the Beckley Foundation, which is a nonprofit. And that was set up in the 90s, back when it was really a kind of dark ages of psychedelic research back then. Mm-hmm. That, you know, mm-hmm. since the prohibition of psychedelics in the 60s, the research had kind of ground to a halt. So the Beckley Foundation was really, the mission there was to reignite scientific interest and research into compounds, because based on the logic that these compounds were being ignored due to social stigma rather mm-hmm. than mm-hmm. good scientific reasons. And so, but, you know, at the time, very few people were actually brave enough to do the research and put their necks on the line. So the Beckley Foundation set up kind of trying to initiate these very early stage research programs and partner with leading scientists and academic institutions around the world. And so it from the 90s, it really became a central hub and a major driving force of psychedelic science, and has been involved, and so my mother Amanda was really at the heart of all of that work, and she's co-authored over 50 peer-reviewed publications on psychedelics, and including many of the kind of most seminal pieces of research. So examples are the scale of drugs, that which was a really interesting study where they compared the scale of harms between legal and illegal drugs. And so, you know, obviously drugs like cocaine, but also tobacco and alcohol come right at the top of the list, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. whereas drugs like psilocybin come very, very low on the list. And that was again published in The Lancet, which is one of the most kind of respected peer-reviewed publications in the world. It had a huge impact on the perception of these compounds, and also set up the Beckley Imperial Psychedelic Research Program, did the first ever brain imaging studies on LSD and psilocybin, which showed what's happening in the brain on these drugs. So anyway, one could go on for a long time, but basically a lot of very exciting research. And I suppose I was fortunate enough, I consider myself fortunate, maybe others would consider myself kind of a victim, but I consider myself fortunate to have grown up surrounded by you know, many of the most influential and brilliant psychedelic researchers in the world. So I kind of, you know, been lucky enough to consider them friends and family. So it wasn't a huge leap for me to get involved in the psychedelic movement, basically. Not very original.
Perhaps not very original, but an amazing continuation of this world-renowned research. And within that, the Beckley Foundation has been prominent for over two decades. How did you go about building out Beckley SciTech off the Beckley Foundations themselves?
Exactly. It's convenient, the analogy. But really, the way it was working was, you know, the Beckley Foundation is a nonprofit, and the focus has been to essentially use science to shine a light and demystify and arguably rehabilitate compounds like LSD and psilocybin, and indeed cannabis and MDMA, and by doing really good science, basically. But the real focus is academic research, proof of concept research, and that was what was really needed back in the 90s and is still needed, right? But it's the kind of early stage proof of concept exploratory research that's being done through the foundation. And then obviously over the last 20 years, what's happened is there's been a kind of snowballing of the evidence base and the interest and more recently the funding being plowed into this field of science. And so about 5 years ago, my mother and I, I'd kind of always worked with the Beckley Foundation. I was even a guinea pig in some of their kind of research. I was one of the people who had my brain imaged in a fMRI machine on psilocybin, which is one of the kind of famous Beckley Imperial studies. And so always been involved in it, but we kind of decided that there was an opportunity to actually expand what we were doing by setting up really targeted drug development companies with the mission to take really the kind of next step in the research. So while Beckley Foundation, again, using your analogy, is building the kind of foundational evidence around psychedelics and their potential therapeutic uses, what Beckley SciTech has been set up to do is actually take the next step, which is take these compounds, build upon this early stage proof of concept data, and actually take these compounds through the proper regulatory drug development process to actually develop licensed medicines that are available to people who are in need. So that's what Beckley SciTech was set up to do. And we co-founded that, and I'm the CEO of that company. And really kind of the two major things that we needed to do from the beginning were, there's a very considerable difference in the skill sets and the experience needed to do academic research versus full scale pharmaceutical drug development. So what we've really tried to do is bring in a best in class drug development kind of pharmaceutical team to help us build upon our knowledge of psychedelics. And then obviously the other thing that's needed for drug development, which is well known, is it's very, very expensive. So one needs to raise a lot of money. And so we've made some good steps in that direction, but certainly not at the end of the road just yet.
The most recent funding round is something that I want to touch on a little bit later. But for the time being, one of the things you mentioned just before is around the compounds that you research and studies are focused around. Much of your current research is centered around developing psilocybin and 5-MeO-DMT treatments. Now, for listeners perhaps not so au fait with 5-MeO-DMT, could you tell us a little bit more about this compound, how it differs to DMT, the primary psychoactive within ayahuasca, and why it holds such great potential as a treatment for neurological disorders?
Yeah, sure. I mean, good question. So 5-MeO-DMT is a kind of more niche psychedelic drug. You have to be quite a kind of psychedelic aficionado to know about 5-MeO-DMT, but those who do know about it, there is a very, very strong following of kind of 5-MeO-DMT within that community. So basically, the what's known about 5-MeO-DMT is it's naturally occurring in various plants and also in probably most famously in the Sonoran desert toad venom. And basically, it's what's interesting about it is it's a very, very potent and very short-acting psychedelic drug. And the reason that we decided that was an interesting candidate for drug development is because we wanted to make sure that what we were doing at Beckley Psytech was contributing meaningfully to the overall movement with psychedelic drug development. And we didn't want to just repeat what others are doing. We wanted to identify real areas of unmet need and real ways to kind of do something meaningfully different and clinically valuable. And so why we landed upon 5-MeO-DMT as our kind of lead candidate was that while there is very exciting existing evidence for drugs like LSD and psilocybin and MDMA within this psychedelic assisted psychotherapy model, which is obviously the combination of the drug and the therapy. And so there's really compelling evidence. I am confident that those drugs will be approved for a range of psychiatric conditions and indeed beyond psychiatry, I think. But the potential challenge that is being posed by those compounds is when you think about the treatment model of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, where one or indeed two therapists have to be in the room with a patient for the entire duration of one of these drug experiences. So that's, you know, LSD is say 10 hours, psilocybin is 6 to 8 hours, MDMA is 6 hours. What you know, they vary obviously, but you know, it's a long period of time that you're requiring the two therapists to sit in a room with a single patient. Now, the results are extremely compelling and it's very exciting. But when you think about how those treatments are going to be rolled out on a global scale, there is potentially a real bottleneck in how one can really scale that and treat as many people as need treatment. So, you know, there is already a global shortage of psychotherapists to deliver normal 1 hour sessions of standard psychotherapy. Suddenly requiring two therapists for a whole day for a single patient poses a real kind of resource utilization challenge for the healthcare system, et cetera. And so what we were really trying to look at was, is there, you know, are there known psychedelics that we can identify characteristics that would allow us to address that major challenge with the longer acting psychedelics? And we landed upon 5-MeO-DMT because what it's known to do is induce these very profound psychedelic experiences, these subjective experiences in the patient or the participant. And these, in the existing literature and research done to date, the intensity of these subjective experiences actually correlate with positive treatment outcomes. And so what one knows about 5-MeO-DMT is it reliably induces these very intense subjective experiences that correlate with positive treatment outcomes. But the duration of that experience is normally under an hour. So what we're really trying to prove with our research is that you can induce similar levels of efficacy that we've seen with MDMA and psilocybin, or even superior levels of efficacy, but the treatment takes an hour rather than a day. And if one can do that, it would allow us to treat many, many more patients. So it's really like that's the logic there. There's a real kind of patient access advantage if we can show that this works. And so that's the reason that we targeted 5-MeO-DMT as our kind of lead candidate. To go back to your point about comparing it to DMT, so, you know, they sound very similar, 5-MeO and 5-MeO-DMT and DMT, but they actually have very marked differences in terms of their subjective experiences. So as you said, DMT is the active ingredient in ayahuasca. When consumed orally in the kind of ayahuasca brew, it actually lasts several hours. But on its own, it's actually not very orally bioavailable, nor is 5-MeO-DMT. So they actually require MAO inhibitors to be able to be orally consumed. Otherwise, you need to either smoke them or kind of inhale them or insufflate them intranasally or inject them, other routes of administration, essentially. And And when you do that with DMT, like 5-MeO-DMT, they're actually both very short-acting drugs. But the reason we decided to focus on 5-MeO rather than on the DMT molecule that's active in ayahuasca is for a couple of main reasons. So interestingly, the subjective experience of 5-MeO-DMT is characterized by being very non-visual and having a very well recognized propensity to induce these kind of mystical type experiences, these ego dissolution type experiences in the people who are taking them. And when we spoke to, you know, a wide variety of experts in the psychedelic field, they were really excited about 5-MeO-DMT because from their experience with drugs like psilocybin and LSD, often the visuals of the subjective experience can be a distraction from the kind of actual therapeutic experience. So I remember Matt Johnson, who's a brilliant researcher at Johns Hopkins, saying that, you know, he's often noticed that when people in a psilocybin therapy session say, "Oh, wow, look at all the pretty pictures. It's like being in a movie." That's sometimes a kind of a telltale sign that they've kind of been distracted and aren't necessarily going to be having the therapeutic response that one's looking for. So by having a kind of non-visual experience, there's a kind of theory that it allows people to be more introspective and focus more on the kind of therapeutic experience that's really the core part of what we're trying to develop. Whereas DMT actually is characterized by being extremely visual. Now, I have no interest in disparaging DMT because it's an absolutely fascinating compound. Mm-hmm, and obviously the ayahuasca community is you know, showing that there's many, many people around the world who have benefited from that therapeutically as well. But it's just a very marked difference. There's this kind of interesting characteristic with DMT that often people kind of report encountering DMT entities, which, you know, is quite a kind of it's quite a difficult thing to explain from a kind of regulatory perspective what exactly that is. 5-MeO-DMT doesn't have that. So we thought, you know, we just decided that 5-MeO was the one that we wanted to put more attention on initially. But I'm very, very enthusiastic about seeing what comes out of the DMT research that's been done as well.
So without the visual properties when somebody ingests 5-MeO-DMT, is the thought behind that also sort of looking at how a medicine of this compound could fit into a traditional medical paradigm? Does the lack of visuals make it easier for, say, medical regulators to get their heads around? Or would it be easier to get approval for a medicine without the visuals so that people could perhaps self-administer the treatment from home?
You know what? That's not the direction that we're going in. I think that the it's still a very intense psychedelic experience that the treatment paradigm in our mind is a new paradigm for psychedelics generally, and that is the combination of psychotherapy and the drug. So we are still anticipating 5-MeO-DMT along with all the other psychedelics that are being at least administered in, you know, psychoactive doses to be administered in a clinic under careful supervision. And we think the regulators are going to require that across the board, actually. So it's not about making it more accessible at home or anything. It just happens to be that 5-MeO-DMT has its own specific kind of characteristics, I suppose, just as DMT has its own characteristics, just as LSD and MDMA, and they all have their own kind of quirks of the characteristics. They, you know, one can try and describe it by they all hit the 5-HT2A receptor, which, you know, and that has an impact on the down regulation of the default mode network and those types of things. So one can try and kind of explain these things in neuroscientific terms, and in the mechanism of action, a lot of them are acting in similar ways, but they all have their own characteristics. They are not all identical. And those differences, whether they're due to the different receptor binding profiles or whether they're due to completely different things, so that the kind of understanding on that sense is not yet complete. But what is understood is that the subjective experience from these different drugs all differ slightly. Now, how does one best utilize each of those different experiences for therapeutic use? That's what we're all really trying to you know, research at the moment, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and earlier you mentioned about working with psychotherapists and that there's a real dearth of psychotherapists in the traditional talk therapy market in general. For folks that you are working with here, what type of training is available and who's leading that training for the therapists? And, well, I guess an extension of that, is there a certain profile of psychotherapist in terms of perhaps their specialism or how long they've been practicing for that you're really looking for that would be a great fit working in conjunction with psychedelic compounds for this assisted therapy?
Yeah, so you know what, it's a really interesting question and kind of subject for the whole industry. So I can talk specifically about what we're doing, but there is a kind of bigger question for the whole industry in my view. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have developed our own specific 5-MeO DMT assisted psychotherapy training manual for psychotherapists who might want to participate in our clinical trials and obviously in the future actually administer these treatments if they become kind of licensed treatments. And so, you know, that involves, there's obviously going to be a lot of overlap with other psychedelics and the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, but we have developed our own program. We're working with a brilliant group called Fluence, who have a lot of experience in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy with MDMA and psilocybin and others. And the kind of, you know, talking about, you know, what are the ideal characteristics of a psychotherapist is obviously a big question. And the interesting thing that we've picked up so far is that, you know, obviously there are a lot of psychotherapists with a prior existing interest in psychedelics personally or having participated in other psychedelic research. So there's a whole kind of growing contingent of those types of people. But what's interesting is that there are also many therapists who have not had personal experiences with psychotherapy who are eager to undertake this training and participate in these types of trials. And so far, the experience that I've spoken to with trainers is that you know, that seems to work very well as well. So that's interesting. And I think, you know, for the kind of overall space, I hope what will happen over the coming years is there will be a level of kind of standardization and kind of cooperation across the industry to try and make the training more accessible so that, you know, not every single company is doing its own siloed therapy. And because obviously logistically mm-hmm. that becomes a real challenge in the long run. At the moment, it's totally fine. But I think in the future, one wants to find ways to make that more efficient and more standardized across the board.
And sorry, just to jump in, how do we get to that point of standardization? You know, you mentioned you guys have your own training modules. Of course, organizations like MAPS also have their own training models. But you look at an area like Oregon, where there are a lot of different in-person and online training courses popping up all over the place. Perhaps it's part of a multi-part question, but how are people able to wade between sort of the wheat and the chaff, so to speak, in terms of this training? And when we do move towards that type of educational training standardization, who do you believe will be at the forefront of it? And how do you see it coming together, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, look, I don't have the answer, if you see what I mean. I have thoughts on the answer. I think mm-hmm. what we will see, and look, I think the people who do research on this and are really eager to understand the space, I think it's, you know, easy enough to identify that the more credible and the less credible organizations in this space. And you know, and then to identify with which ones appeal most to the particular therapists who kind of want to participate in these training programs as well. So there's going to be a sense of choice. I think what I hope happens in the long run is that there is a kind of almost what a kind of standardized package of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy training. And then there are modules that you can kind of add on for different drugs and different indications and different treatment models so that you can kind of like, you can kind of do the basic training and then you can build upon that, but you don't have to do the full training each time you want to add a new kind of string to your bow or something like that. So that's what I think I think we will end up eventually. And I think there are already conversations going on. You know, there's and to your point with Oregon, with MAPS is phase three being set up. There's a huge, you know, I really think over the next few years, we're going to see an ecosystem growing out of the research that's being done that will allow kind of treatments to become available organically, as well as, you know, and then obviously there are companies who are focused on setting up psychedelic therapy clinics and things like that. But I also think there is this kind of organic emergence of various clinics, like various sites that have been doing research and now wanting to set up as clinics. So you're going to see that happening over the next few years. And it's going to be a really interesting kind of evolution, I think, but going from a pure research to a research and also providing kind of available licensed treatment. So that's all I think to watch out for in the next few years, basically.
There are so many more questions I'd love to ask you, Cosmo, especially pertaining to psychotherapists and, of course, your clinical trials. But as our time is running thin, perhaps one more question. I wanted to circle back to your Series B funding round. Your initial target was 50 million and you've absolutely smashed through that, basically twofold. What does an additional financial war chest of over 100 million mean for an organization like yours? And does this potentially open the door or the doors to new areas of research to explore using that additional funding that perhaps you guys hadn't previously factored into your plans?
Yeah, I think that's, again, it's a good question. It's certainly, so since we did our funding round last year, and I would say we are delighted about two decisions we made. One was to stay as a private company, and the other was to raise more money than we originally intended because there was so much demand. And actually what's happened in the interim between then and now is that the kind of global markets, for a variety of reasons, have really changed. And so money and investment is much less easily available right now than it was a year ago, let's say. And so we're very grateful to have the additional funds to be able to continue doing our research and continue focusing on building data and progressing our products. And to your point, having the opportunity to potentially expand our kind of pipeline and our portfolio of programs. So we have that additional flexibility and that additional kind of option to keep going without having to go back to investors if the markets for you know, a variety of macroeconomic reasons remain, you know, really not very good, then we can just carry on doing the work we need to do. So that's, and I think it's wonderful for the whole space that there was such a inflow of research. You know, it's incredible, having been involved in psychedelic research arguably my whole life, but you know, really watching it carefully for at least 20 years. The idea that, you know, I've watched my mother at the Beckley Foundation, which is obviously a charity, but, you know, spend innumerable hours and days of her life trying to raise relatively small amounts of money to facilitate research at amazing research at amazing institutions, doing really, really important work. And obviously she's put a great deal of her own and our family's money into that as well. And, you know, and then to suddenly, within a year and a half of setting up this company, or 2 years, to have raised over $100 million, and for the whole industry now to have raised $2 billion or more, you know, to do psychedelic research. It's an incredibly exciting time for those of us who have been wanting to see research done. So, you know, there is so much possibility if that money is now used in responsible and sensible and intelligent ways, there is so much that we can learn about psychedelics and so much good that can be done with these compounds. So it's you know, it's an incredibly exciting moment. And I think, you know, I'm delighted that so much money has flowed into this space. And I think amazing things are going to come out of it. over the next few years.
No doubt. And we'll absolutely have to get you back on the pod to hear how things are developing at your end. But unfortunately, right now, Cosmo, the clock has beaten us. So I'd like to say thank you so, so much for joining us on Professionally Psychedelics.
Well, it was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.